Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on the program, Walt Disney presented a lifelike animatronic figure of Abraham Lincoln at the 1964 World's Fair.
For Walt Disney, it was a really great opportunity to showcase a lot of the theme park technology to an East Coast audience.
We'll discuss The Storm, an antebellum tale of Key West, written by Ellen Brown Anderson in the mid-1800s, but published now for the first time.
The Storm is told by a first-person retrospective narrator. Her name is Jenny Mansfield.
All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
The world has never had a good definition of the word liberty. And the American people just now are much in want of one.
Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln is still a popular attraction at Disneyland, and it paved the way for the more expansive Hall of Presidents at Disney World. As Sebastian Garcia reports, the lifelike animatronic figure of Abraham Lincoln made its debut at the 1964 World's Fair.
Dr. Brian Miller is a professor of history and a department chair at the University of Central Florida. He is currently developing a book manuscript examining how Walt Disney used Civil War memory in creating his famous 1964 World's Fair attraction, Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln. The 1964-65 World's Fair, held in New York City, provided a promising platform for Disney to expose East Coast audiences to his theme park attractions. He also used the fair to experiment with his theme park technology and strengthen the company's corporate partnerships.
For Walt Disney, it was a really great opportunity to showcase a lot of the theme park technology to an East Coast audience. When Disneyland was established, it was mostly a West Coast audience. It was definitely more of a locals park in Los Angeles, but there really hadn't been any direct connection to the East Coast. And this would be a really great opportunity for the Disney company to be involved, especially because there were numerous corporations that were going to sponsor pavilions. So it wouldn't require an enormous amount of capital on behalf of the Walt Disney Company. They would create the attractions, but they would essentially be paid for by different corporate sponsors to create some sort of synergy. This is something that Disney had been interested in with the theme parks and getting corporate synergy in order to fund some of the attractions itself, to take some of the financial burden, particularly because of how expensive a lot of the technology would become.
In 1963, Disneyland opened Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room, which featured numerous robotic singing birds. The attraction remains one of Disney's first ventures into audio animatronic technology, which enables robotic figures to move, talk, and sing in synchronization with an audio soundtrack. Disney viewed the 1964-65 World's Fair as an opportunity to expand this technology by creating human-like audio animatronic figures. He conceptualized an exhibit intended for the U.S. government pavilion titled One Nation Under God, which would include audio animatronic figures of all the U.S. presidents, essentially a precursor to the Hall of Presidents attraction in Walt Disney World's Magic Kingdom. Despite the head of the World's Fair, Robert Moses' push, and President John F. Kennedy's support, members of Congress refused to approve the exhibit if Disney remained a central participant in its creation.
So the original vision for it was going to be a multi-million dollar need for this pavilion. And essentially, the audiences would come into a huge theater where they would watch a film that would have great sound in the theater itself. And at the end of the film, the screens would rise up and you would see all of the audio animatronic figures of the presidents of the United States. So this is essentially the Hall of Presidents as it exists today at Walt Disney World's Magic Kingdom. But that was going to be enormously expensive. And so because this was going to be the United States' federal government pavilion, Moses needed permission from the federal government. He needed funding from the government to do this pavilion. And while President John F. Kennedy was very supportive of Moses and the endeavor to build the pavilion, members of Congress weren't so keen on Walt Disney actually being the focal point participant of this pavilion. And I think this shows you the changing nature of Walt's legacy, of how we view him today versus how he was viewed at the time period. Theme parks, it wasn't a place where a lot of regular folks went. Disneyland, by many audiences who hadn't been there, was seen as a glorified carnival. And Walt was viewed, the Undersecretary of Commerce, Franklin Delano Roosevelt Jr., even noted to Walt that people viewed him as a carnival barker, sort of a sideshow man creating attractions that weren't really true. So that's how Walt was viewed at the time period from members of Congress, even though he was on people's living rooms every night showcasing Disneyland's technology. So when the federal pavilion went forward, Walt wasn't allowed to participate in it. And so there was no way for him to do a Hall of Presidents. So this is what allowed Walt to sort of focus on, well, maybe we'll build just one figure, Abraham Lincoln, and try that out for the fair itself.
Developing the audio animatronic Lincoln proved challenging, especially considering the realism Disney sought to showcase with this human-like robotic figure. Such technological realism generated strong reactions from the audience and the press.
The figure as he would be developed was pretty remarkable for the time period. The fact that he wasn't just going to stand in place. One of the things that they wanted was a big wow moment. And so Abraham Lincoln is sitting in a chair and he actually uses his arms to lift himself up out of the chair, deliver the speech, and then he sits back down at the end, which is a technologically advanced maneuver, particularly because with that much hydraulic pressure that's being built up within the figure itself, some of the test runs of Mr. Lincoln shattered the chair when he sat back down. So they had to work it just right, so he just carefully sat back down into the position itself. There were numerous facial expressions that the figure could do, over 20, I believe, in the early incantations of the figure itself. He could raise eyebrows, and it really created a standard to the point of when audiences went into that theater, people thought it was an actor. It became routinely remarked upon audiences that they wanted to know who the actor was. Could they meet him after the show? And they were stunned at the fact that this actor was continually performing this multiple times a day, as several times an hour. It was enormously impressive. And it also, I think, created some backlash for Disney in the press, in that people really wondered, should we make robotic versions of our presidents? It made members of Congress nervous, which I think is why there was this antagonism against the attraction. Because we had seen like these sideshows around the country with wax figures of many different historical figures. And should we be doing that for our presidents, was the question.
Once the Illinois state government created a pavilion to house Mechanical Lincoln, writing a script for the audio animatronic president constituted the final step in its development. Dr. Miller contends that Disney invoked a memory of the Civil War that reflected contemporary ideologies about the Cold War and the fight against communism.
Many in Illinois thought, well, the most appropriate thing for Lincoln to say in this presentation would be the Gettysburg Address. But Walt was vehemently opposed to that because there would be that shock and awe moment when you saw the figure rise up. But then if he delivers the Gettysburg Address, you knew that was probably what he was going to say. And Walt, I think, had this keen ability to understand audiences' expectations before I think even they knew what they were. You think about the way that Disney likes to surprise its guests as you move through attractions, the big wow moments. You're like, oh, especially the first time you ride something, you're like, that's so cool. And that's what he was hoping with this particular attraction. So Walt actually had some script writers, two men who worked on the script, and they used a variety of Lincoln speeches. There was a fragment of a tariff discussion that Lincoln gave in December of 1847, a speech that he gave in Connecticut in March of 1860 as he was launching on his pre-election sort of tour of the Northeast, a speech he gave in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1859, and then two pieces of the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And they're all sort of woven together. And it's pretty fascinating because the script itself is exactly what the United States' Civil War Centennial Commission, because this is coming at the same time that the country is celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Civil War. They were really looking for messages that tied the American Civil War to the fight against communism during the Cold War. And so a lot of the themes that Lincoln talks about in this particular presentation is very much about liberty, about freedom, and sort of woven together that for audiences in the 1960s, they were hearing Lincoln's words from 100 years ago, but they were seeing it within the context of the Cold War itself.
By the end of 1964, approximately 3 million people attended Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln. Another few million experienced the attraction during the fair's second year in 1965. Walt Disney and his company significantly benefited from the World's Fair, particularly for his Florida project. In addition to expanding his audience to an East Coast populace, Disney applied the human-like audio animatronic technology he tested at the fair to several Walt Disney World attractions, including the Haunted Mansion, the Hall of Presidents, both opening day attractions at Magic Kingdom, Pirates of the Caribbean, among others. Disney also used his other three corporate-sponsored pavilions from the fair as the basis for other Walt Disney World theme park attractions, such as It's a Small World, the Carousel of Progress, and World of Motion. Except for World of Motion, these attractions maintain their original corporate sponsor from the fair, underlining the corporate synergy Disney sought to achieve with the 1964-65 World's Fair.
Because Walt was able to expose East Coast audiences, and it's kind of silly to think about this today, but East Coast audiences had very different enjoyments, aesthetic theme parks were very different on the East Coast. They were used to sort of the boardwalks of New Jersey in the summer, the Coney Island style of theme park. And now you're having this audio animatronic, this realism, this escapism, this very specific storytelling in a ride that you hadn't experienced that in the Coney Island funhouses, for example, the haunted houses. There'd just be random ghosts and things that would pop out. Walt wanted to tell an entire story from beginning to end of the attraction. So it was really important to expose East Coast audiences, particularly New Yorkers, the largest population center, to what the Walt Disney Company had to offer in terms of theme park attractions. And the technology that they were able to use was to see how these human forms worked and how what audiences' reaction would be, not just to Abraham Lincoln, but also John, who is the family host inside the Progress Land, the Carousel of Progress, and his dog. And you start to see how those human figures, the way they're able to move, then Walt is able to take that technology as the Imagineers at the time period are developing the Pirates of the Caribbean, the Haunted Mansion, attractions that are very heavily involved with human figures. This was sort of the testing ground to see what they could do, how they would be able to move, and what sort of ability they would be able to create these stories with. And Walt, he had four different involvement in the pavilions at the World's Fair, and he used all four of them in the theme parks. Pepsi had been involved with UNICEF in the Small World attraction pavilion, and that would be an opening day attraction at Magic Kingdom and Walt Disney World, and then would be built in the same style it was at the World's Fair. The Progress Land, the Journey Through the 20th Century Family, which we know as the Carousel of Progress, opened at Magic Kingdom in January of 1975. The attraction also was in Disneyland for a period of time as well and remains at the Magic Kingdom. The third attraction was the Ford Magic Skyway, where you sat in these Ford vehicles that were on a track and you went through the history of time. You saw dinosaurs, the Grand Canyon, and then taking that idea, because those cars were external. So when you're walking by the ride, you can see the cars on a ramp sort of going in, and it was to lure you in like, oh, what's that? I can see the ride attraction. And for my listeners who remember riding a World of Motion at Epcot that General Motors had actually sponsored, you may remember that the ride vehicles were on the outside going in. So it's sort of that concept the company would actually use at Epcot.
As for the audio animatronic Lincoln, he served as the model for the Hall of Presidents attraction in Walt Disney World's Magic Kingdom, which has since added contemporary presidents and remains in operation. The mechanical president continues to entertain audiences in Disneyland and will soon share the stage with its creator, as the Walt Disney Company plans to celebrate the park's 70th birthday next summer with a Great Moments with Walt Disney attraction that will rotate with mechanical Lincoln. A symbolic gesture, given that Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln remains one of the last attractions Walt Disney designed and directed himself.
The attraction's been closed recently for a little bit because this summer, Walt Disney Imagineering has created its very first Walt Disney audio animatronic. And the show will actually rotate between Mr. Lincoln and Great Moments, if you will, with Walt Disney, where we will be invited into Walt Disney's office and he will be there on the stage to talk about his career and what's going on in the Disney parks, probably. It's, I think, a full circle moment in many ways when you think about how involved Walt was in creating this Lincoln attraction. And now it will be paired with an attraction featuring himself in probably the most advanced audio animatronic that the company has ever created.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
Let us have faith that right makes might. And in that faith, let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, listen to archived editions of this program, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
And after the storm, run and run as the rains come, and I look up, I look up, on my knees and out of luck, I look up.
The Storm, an antebellum tale of Key West by Ellen Brown Anderson, believed to be the first novella written by a woman in Florida, is being published for the first time by the University Press of Florida. The book is edited by Keith Honeycutt, professor of English at Florida Southern College. The unsigned manuscript of The Storm was donated to the University of Florida in 2015. Knowing that Honeycutt had edited the book Echoes from a Distant Frontier, the Brown Sisters' correspondence from antebellum Florida, 1835 to 1850, with James M. Denham, UF's Jim Cusick sent a copy of the unpublished manuscript to Honeycutt, since it might have been written by Ellen Brown Anderson.
I looked at the manuscript, and I was convinced immediately that it was Ellen's. And so I went up to UF, and Jim showed it to me, and let me read it and take digital photos so that I could study it a little bit better. And then he showed me, on top of that, the donor card. It was donated by Gary Nips in 2015. So I had a clue, and then a bigger clue. He gave me a copy of an unpublished and sort of partially finished introduction to The Storm that someone else had done. And it was a lawyer, an Alachua County lawyer named Norm LeCoe. And of course, I immediately knew the name because Norm LeCoe was also involved with the letters of the Brown Sisters when they first appeared in Florida. So I knew that anything he said would have some validity to it. He wasn't just entirely guessing. And so Norm's unpublished essay guessed that it might be the Brown Sisters.
Keith Honeycutt believed he had enough evidence to conclude that Ellen Brown Anderson had written The Storm, but he thought it was important to track down Norm LeCoe to get his perspective on the unpublished novel.
He had moved out of Alachua County and down to Naples and was retired and was a little bit hard to find. But old reliable Mike Denham said he would go with me. And so we headed down to Naples and found Norm and talked to him. And he turned over to me a box full of letters and manuscripts, all sorts of copies of stuff, and told me that I could borrow it for a while. And so I started sifting through those letters for evidence about the storm and its origins. And then, and this was back in Lakeland, where I live and where I work. And then Norm and I started a very fruitful correspondence about how he got his hands on not only those letters, but the manuscript of the storm. So he had seen both of them, both the manuscript for the storm and all of those hundreds of letters before Mike or I ever saw them. So, I mean, his perspective was a little different from ours, and he is a full-time lawyer and couldn't devote as much time to them as we could, but still he had some pretty good hunches and some good evidence. And so I just started putting all that together, and before long I was convinced that it was the Brown sisters and mostly Ellen. Maybe Corinna had a hand in it, but it was mostly Ellen.
In 1835, Ellen and Corinna moved from Portsmouth, New Hampshire to St. Augustine and then to Mandarin, Florida. Eventually, they made their way to Key West. Keith Honeycutt.
Their Aunt Delia had set up a hat shop in St. Augustine, and apparently she was a pretty brave soul, and she, you know, urged them to move down and, you know, said, "Life's great in Florida, come on down." And so one of their older sisters, Adelaide, came down in 1833 and immediately died from fever. But that didn't discourage them. They came down in 1835. And by then, Delia had married Dr. James Hall of Mandarin, a rich planter. And he said, "Y'all come on and live with us." And so the sisters moved to a smaller house on the plantation in Mandarin. And from there, they moved all around St. Augustine, Jacksonville. And eventually, as you mentioned, Corinna married Edward Aldrich in maybe 1837 or 8. And then in 1840, Ellen married Captain James Anderson, who was stationed in Florida, as you might guess, as part of the Second Seminole War to fight the Seminoles. And Dr. Aldrich was a surgeon who followed the army. So they moved all over Florida, including Noonansville, Mineral Springs, Pensacola, Picolata, I believe, just all over the place. By 1847, James was with his unit of the army, and they were in Mexico, and he was killed. Churubusco, I believe, is where they were, just outside Mexico City. And so the rest of them were in Pensacola at the time. And so Edward wanted to apply for the job as a Marine surgeon in Key West.
Ellen Brown Anderson was a widow with three children who followed her sister Corinna and her husband to Key West. The family was not in Key West for the Havana hurricane of 1846, but their letters indicate that they discussed the storm thoroughly with residents who were there. Ellen's novella, The Storm, centers around the life of a 16-year-old girl.
The storm is told by a first-person retrospective narrator. Her name is Jenny Mansfield, but she is... And she's an older adult, and she's remembering her year in Key West when she was 16, and her name was Jenny Greenow, because she had just gotten married. She was, and we're talking about the character now, not Ellen Anderson anymore. I get the two mixed up sometime, but they're completely distinct. It's Ellen's character that I'm talking about now. So Jenny is from New York, and this physician, Peter Greenow, he's 29, he's a little older, Marries her, her family approves, and he takes her to Key West to get rich, as people did in 1840, late 1840s, because I guess you know it was a boom town back then. So that was the reason that the character is there. And she describes it as a beautiful place, of course. And she lives in a beautiful house, and the manuscript has drawings. It has one drawing that shows the view from her front porch, and that's the cover photo for the book, The Storm. Okay, so she loves her life there at first until she starts to feel a little bit of disillusionment with being married at that age, and a little discontent because her husband dismisses her. Her concerns and her worries and her interests. She tries to make other friends, but he clamps down on her and won't let her socialize much. So the story becomes pretty complex with her struggles with this life. She does get out some in the daytime, and he disappears. Supposedly doing his doctoring work. She meets some people. She goes to the lighthouse and talks to the lighthouse keeper and his family. And they talk about things like women's education, which I guess everybody was doing back then. And she's again unhappy that she doesn't have a profession that she can fall back on. So that there's a lot about her. That makes Jenny an interesting character for a 16-year-old, but she's not happy entirely with life as it is.
In the book, the storm destroys Jenny's house and kills her husband and sister, who Jenny discovers were planning to elope to England. Without giving too much away, Jenny does have a happy ending and a fulfilling life. Ellen Brown Anderson did not achieve her dream of becoming a successful writer, but her book, The Storm, An Antebellum Tale of Key West, is now published by the University Press of Florida. We spoke with editor Keith Honeycutt. Get over your hill and see what you find there with grace in your heart and flowers in your hair. You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Visit us anytime on Facebook at Florida Historical Society or on our website at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Sebastian Garcia and Connie Lester. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.